Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Yeah, I usually open this with some variation of Happy Something Day, but I can't muster it up today, so it's a day.
Happy Groundhog Day, because that's what it feels like every time we face Pitt.
Yep, I literally said probably 20 times this week to various people, I think I would have rather faced literally any team in the ACC except for Pitt. I think I would have just said, let's just see what happens with UNC.
Same.
Or Virginia. Pitt is the last team I wanted to face in what I'm pretty sure will have shaken out to be a must-win game. I guess we'll know Sunday if it really was. But yeah, that was it was exactly what we thought. Like, they jumped out, looked pretty good to start, and then Pitt figured it out, and then they took the lead, and then Syracuse, you know. They don't usually, in the last couple of years, they haven't been getting blown out by Pitt. They've just been losing in the most heartbreaking way possible, which involves multiple comebacks and actually keeping it close and looking competitive. It really played out pretty perfectly, considering all of our deepest fears about this game heading in.
Yeah, and you know what, I think, like, for me, anyone telling themselves that Syracuse is going to win that one was fooling themselves, if only because it's Pitt, and it doesn't matter where we play them, it doesn't matter when lately. When Jamie Dixon's on the sidelines, there's just something that he understands about beating this zone, especially recent iterations, which, at least the last 2 years, I feel like have faltered inside a little bit. I just think, you know, you can debate all day what happened on that last play. It was obvious that the original plan was broken. If they had had a timeout, they probably would have called it. But without one, you're kind of stuck with what you have. And it just seemed like there was no option B for the team. And that's how you get Trevor Cooney taking a three in the waning seconds instead of driving the lane when you could easily probably draw a foul going up. But moving on from that, and we don't have to move on completely, even though we want to, I just noticed that Georgia Tech managed to come back from 18 down to beat Clemson. So Clemson lost today, so that's nice, right? Just for the sake of Clemson feeling like shit for a day.
Sure.
And Holy Cross won their conference tournament despite being the ninth seed out of 10 in the Patriot League and being 14-19 overall. So Boston College can also take some solace / misery in that.
Roll damn Crusaders.
Yeah, so back to Syracuse, because we can only take solace in minor victories for so long. Dan, what was the most frustrating part about this game other than the predictability of it? I know I was talking to my coworker, who's also a Syracuse grad, and he and I said before the game exactly what would happen in the order you described it a couple minutes ago, and that was SU starts hot, Pitt closes the gap by the half, Pitt looks to put us away, Syracuse comes back and makes it a game, SU loses in excruciating fashion.
I'm going to say, like, aside from it following the strip to a T, like, it actually wasn't, stylistically the classic Pitt game. Like, Pitt is usually, you know, they go to the free throw line with one of their forwards, and they carve up the zone from the high-low post game, and they do it really well, and that's, like, usually their method of just absolutely shredding us. Today, they hit 40% of their threes, which, you know, they're a decent shooting team, but that's not really their game. They had a guy, and we should have probably known this would happen to some degree, but Cam Johnson today, that's like an all-time random guy going off. Like, it's not like, you know, guy off the bench who never drops 13. Like, dude that averages 4 points, who scored double digits twice heading into the day, leads all scorers, tied with Benajay for 24.
Because, of course. Yeah.
Like, that's just that, and just the whole thing was just so frustrating. Even, and we wasted, you know, Benajay had a pretty heroic effort. I thought Daywon had maybe his best game of his career, 11-11. You know, finished 5-7 from the field, like, was able to actually convert most of the time, played 33 minutes, which is huge for him. Just, we had some things working, and the comeback was really great. Like, two comebacks where we came really close, and then Pitt extended out the lead with like 2 minutes left, and it looked like that was pretty much it, and then the team came roaring back to tie it, and then obviously the really bad Franklin Howard turnover Dave Pitt the lead, and just it seemed like SU had, you know, we've seen this team in the last couple of years pull off wins like this where they have the comebacks, and Benajay especially was leading the way and had a really awesome game like he's had all year, and deserves so much credit for what he pulled off this year. And just not being able to get over that hump is just so frustrating.
Yeah, and you know what? And this is just to put perspective on it for people, myself included, really. This was a lot like the Duke game in a lot of ways. It was a different outcome. And you could look at that Duke game in a lot of different ways, and people might have said things about officiating, and you can laugh at them, especially if their name's Mike Krzyzewski. But there were a lot of similarities. There was a lot of back and forth. And it just so happened that one of those games, the Duke one, ended on our side. This one didn't. I'm not going to sit here and point fingers at any one player. I know a lot of fans are quick to, and I think that's something that we can address here. Maybe not right yet, but Dan, you and I already started discussing it, and that is, you know, the scapegoating of one Trevor Cooney.
Yeah, and obviously there was some... This was a very strange game for Cooney because... and I tweeted it during the game, like the last time... When was the last time that Cooney sat out for 11 or 12 minutes straight in a competitive basketball game? Maybe two seasons ago? So clearly, Boeheim had either he liked what he saw from Howard running the offense, or he had frustrations. I'm looking through. I think this might have been Cooney's only game under 30 minutes this year. No, he had Montana State. He played 28.
Well, I saw there was a stat that Dio sent out. I forgot who. Maybe somebody else. Where it was like, this is the first game that Cooney played 25 minutes or less since the Fordham game, like 96 games ago.
Yeah, so clearly there was some different mindset with Boeheim here. And I think him sitting Cooney for all that time really played into a lot of people's frustrations with Cooney. I think the scapegoating in the last, and you know, Cooney didn't have a good game. He hasn't had a good game in a while. Louisville was really his last one, and you know he is the player he is. I don't know why everyone decided that like this whole he's the next GMAT narrative wasn't a come. Is it? I mean, you can't just brand every white shooting guard that comes through the program as the next Jerry or the next whomever. It's completely unfair. But he's been a reliable defender. He's been a totally good citizen. He's played like a number of very good games. It's not like Cooney's never had a good game for Syracuse. He's very streaky, and he shouldn't be like the number one or two player on a good team, but he has his role. And then it all came to a head with that last play where, if you look at it, and I watched it a number of times, there was really nothing else for Cooney to do. He maybe didn't have to cross back over and could have taken another step or, you know, taken an extra second and a half to get closer to the hoop, but everyone always harps on Cooney only shooting whatever percentage from inside the arc. It's about the same as what he shoots from three. Benajay was totally covered. Leiden and Roberson were like basically bunched up under the hoop with guys in the passing lanes. Malachi was about 30 feet away until the last second. He was in no position. So Cooney had the best shot based on that broken play. And unfortunately he didn't hit it because it still wasn't like a completely wide open look. And sometimes people miss shots, but, it's just really unfortunate how it played out. And I was really turned off by a lot of the Syracuse fans online. And I know it's easy to jump on Cooney. I know he hasn't been this perfect player throughout his career, but man, like that play, like he did what he could do based on a very tough situation with no timeouts, with Pitt totally trying to take away Benajay, who was obviously option one. And he still, you know, he got a somewhat decent look and a shot that he's hit a number of times. So it's frustrating to see people scapegoat a player like that, especially one who's, you know, been in the program for 5 years and has really done nothing wrong except miss some shots. And anything he's done wrong at Syracuse basketball has been on the court. And I'll take that most of the time. But to see, like, comparisons to, like, Fab Mello as a Syracuse player people hate the most, but and even hating on people like that, like it's just really frustrating to see the worst come out of people over something so menial.
Yeah, I have to agree with you there. And I mean, I definitely saw some of those comparisons. You know, I agreed with the sentiment of the fact that he was hated, not the fact that I was joining in on it. And I think that was the case with some people too. I know that I saw the Fab Melo comparisons more in the case that I didn't see some of them as bad as you did. I think more because I just decided to like basically mute everything afterward. But I did see the one comparison, just like fans wrongfully kind of having those two lumped together seems weird. And a lot of it is exactly what, you know, Sean was saying in that article the other day. He was saying, you know, the book on Cooney's been written already. There's just no saving him from it. And I think, unfortunately, this kind of sick karmic justice that was dealt to him today just kind of reinforced it. Is that, you know, if Syracuse doesn't make the NCAA tournament, Cooney's SU career will basically be bookended by two big misses, and it will not be populated by all the shots that he's hit during his career. Which, I mean, yes, that rate has fallen off a ton, but it hasn't fallen off to the point where he just stopped doing things as a player. I still think he's been an effective player. I think I wouldn't call him a great defender, but I think he can be a smart defender and an opportunistic one at times. And I think I think that he has his flaws, and I don't think that he ever really lived up to the, you know, unfair, probably, characterizations of him that people were ready to heap on. But I don't think he's been the negative player and the lightning rod for just vitriol that people have made him out to be, sometimes myself included, to be honest, over the last couple of years.
Yeah, and it's not like you can't be frustrated with him. And Cooney's a very frustrating basketball player. Everyone who's watched Syracuse kind of knows that, because you see the games where he drops 27 or he, you know, destroys Notre Dame and goes crazy. So I totally understand being frustrated and venting that line's fine, but like people tweeting directly at him and people, you know, saying they can't wait for him to be off the team, like there are going to be points next year where we really probably wish we had Trevor Cooney for another year. So I just, like, personal attacks, and especially in college sports, just drive me totally insane when you consider, you know, all the work these kids put in, the fact that they're not paid when, you know, I think both of us agree that they should be in some form. It's really gross. And I know it's not a Syracuse problem. It's a sports fan problem across the board. But I don't like to see, like, the people that I consider my Syracuse brethren here kind of show their really nasty side. And unfortunately, it came out today, and I didn't really have the ability to just block it out, because being on Twitter is part of my job, so that wasn't great. I had to mute a lot of people and just get away from it, because it was getting really gross. And it wasn't like I wish Trevor Cooney was better at basketball. It's like personal insults against Trevor Cooney because he's not the basketball player you wish he was, which is just insanity.
Yeah, and again, it's one of these things where it isn't a Syracuse problem. It's just an intrinsic problem with the way fans conduct themselves, and I don't know if we want to blame Twitter for this. I don't know if we want to blame, just kind of maybe the level of discourse has changed. Blame Donald Trump. I don't care. It's become a big part of the fan experience that I could do without, and that is like the personal attacks and just complete and utter disregard for people and as fellow human beings. it wears on me. I know it wears on you, and I'm sure it wears on a lot of other fans too. It's not something that needs to be part of it. And just because you have direct access to people and players now, doesn't necessarily mean that you have to use it, especially in that regard.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, because so much good does come out of it, and it is cool to see a lot of these players showing their personality. You know, not so much Cooney, he's not all that active on there, more Benajay and others, but when you have people just, you know, who had their afternoon ruined because of a 12 p.m. basketball game and decide to just, you know, crap all over someone's livelihood, it's just really unfortunate. So hopefully, I don't know, I can now I'm unfortunately like seeing Cooney like averaging 25 points in the NIT, and everyone's gonna be just giving him like bronze cheers for it, so that'll be fun.
Yeah, I can see that going poorly in my mind.
Yeah, there's no way Cooney can win from here on out, so hopefully I don't know. Hopefully, when he comes back to school as a graduate, people don't give him like the Dante Green treatment, especially because even that's like a totally unfair thing. But that's like the last person that I remember really getting crapped on when he's returned, and from a large portion of the fan base.
Yeah, the Dante Green treatment is definitely an interesting theory and just an interesting phenomenon in general. I think he's become just a weird kind. Like, I understand why people have venom toward Fab Melo, and rightfully so. And I think we're far enough removed now from him being here, and his relevance in sports in general is far enough removed from everybody that I think, it's worth visiting. But yeah, I think with Dante Green, there was just so much anger and vitriol towards a player that, no, he probably shouldn't have left. But him leaving kind of opened a door for two to five very successful years for Syracuse. And, you know, if he sticks around, maybe we don't get certain players come in the door. And yes, recent, you know, recruiting strikeouts, maybe not, those didn't happen either, but we don't know. And I don't necessarily think that Dante Green makes the six overtime team better. I don't know if Dante Green makes the Wes Johnson team better, or if the Wes Johnson team exists with Dante Green. I mean, there's too many variables, and I don't even think it's worth getting mad at him for. I mean, obviously it didn't work out. Obviously he has regrets, and you know what? Maybe we do too, just as fans, for not enjoying that he was a quality player when he was with Syracuse, and that we just appreciate the fact that, you know, he understands that he enjoys his time while he was there, but he made a decision that was right for him at the time.
Yeah, and it's like this like gross inverse with Cooney. Like, Green left after 1 year. He had kind of, you know, pretty big stats in terms of his scoring, but the team only made the NIT and never really lived up to the, you know, and they didn't help themselves with the whole dynasty thing. But then Cooney, you have, who was here for 5 years, played, you know, people, if they try to deny that he played hard, they're just being ridiculous. He wasn't the best player by any means. He was, you know, I would say an average player overall with the ability to go crazy occasionally, which I think is fair. But, you know, people wanted him run off the team all 3 years that he was a big factor. So I guess there's really no winning unless you are a perfect player for your entire career. But you also stay exactly how long people want you, and not less or more.
No, and I think that has become the mantra, especially of college fans who they know that the players that they love and appreciate or hate and abhor the most have an expiration date with them. It has become a wild phenomenon. I think about it. Syracuse has, and we've discussed, and I discussed with Sean, there's Syracuse fans and have a weird, and I don't disclude us from this, have a weird detachment syndrome and attachment issues, and if that makes any sense, with players, with coaches. I think once Boeheim hangs them up, we're always going to be petrified of someone leaving us. And I think you saw it with Schaefer and his firing. And to be honest, any coach that put up the results he did through 3 years, especially in the order that they happened, is probably gone at any Power 5 program. But you have a vocal portion of the fan base that says his work wasn't done. He had results he didn't do. He wasn't allowed to do what he was supposed to do. And I don't buy that for a second. And not just because by the end he wasn't my guy, because at the beginning he was. I think that, you know, Syracuse fans just have this weird old school mentality. And some of that's because of Boeheim, that, you know, people can't leave you. People are supposed to be there forever. And I just don't think that's realistic in life. I don't think that's realistic in careers. I don't think that's realistic in college athletics in particular, in today's day and age.
Yeah. And we're about to enter into, and about, who knows when that actually is, but we are kind of, quote, lucky enough, unquote, to apparently be handing the torch to another person. I think Hop's going to do a good job.
And he's somebody who's not going to leave.
He's probably not going to leave, because there aren't that many better jobs. And I don't think, I mean, what job is Hop going to leave for, unless he wants to go to the NBA? And that's assuming a lot of success. But it is, I mean, we have talked about this on the football side. especially with like Marone leaving and whatnot, but there definitely is this sense of like more of an old school way of how college sports went that I feel like it's just a lot of other programs have been thrown into the fire before us, and Syracuse has just happened to have all this continuity in its coaching across the board that now we're kind of getting taught the lessons that everyone else learned in like the 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah, I mean, look at the other top programs. Not even making comparisons that we are any of these top programs. But, like, look at – Duke is yet to do this, and people keep forgetting that. Duke is yet to do this, but they've accomplished enough success that they probably won't have to at the same level SU is. Like, look at what UCLA's been for much of the last 20 years. You know, look at what Kentucky's sunk to at certain points. You know, look at – what North Carolina, I mean, people forget that the Daugherty years, like the year that they went like 8-20 at North Carolina, like that shouldn't happen for North Carolina, but it did. And like when Arizona dropped off for a few years, like these programs drop off and like they get replaced by people who could be there forever or could not. And I just think Syracuse fans are going to get spoiled once again by somebody because, yeah, you know, you're right. There aren't a lot of jobs better than Syracuse in all of college basketball, and that's weird because in football there are a lot that are better. But, yeah, I think it's going to be weird that SU fans get to basically inherit a Boeheim situation after Boeheim and potentially not for another 30 years deal with the type of change that every other fan base in college sports you know, has dealt with.
Right, and I think a lot of the I think the how good the Syracuse job is, a lot of it's going to be defined by what Hopkins does, because Boeheim is just, you can almost write off 40 years if you really want to as just Boeheim was X. So the Hopkins era, whenever it does start, and obviously I think we have, you know, another two or three years of Boeheim. Realistically, it's whenever Boeheim wants to leave. I don't think anyone's going to force a timetable on him, but. I think that will really help define what the Syracuse program is going forward, because after that, you know, you can't. It's really hard to expect us to keep on turning over coaches and having people from within the program every year. Although I know people have this like glowing expectation that Jerry will take over the program in like 30 years.
That's not how it works.
And if it happens, that'd be hilarious and wonderful, but you know, odds are after Hopkins will probably be a non-Syracuse person.
Yeah, or I mean, and who can really predict the next 30 years? I mean, it's not as if the distance between Hopkins and Jerry age-wise is not the same as the distance between Hopkins and Jim, and nobody should start fooling themselves into thinking that. The only way Jerry takes over this team is if Hopkins leaves of his own accord well before he's done. I think that I want Hopkins to succeed. If I wasn't a Syracuse fan, I'd be very interested to see what would happen if he didn't.
Yeah, it's kind of scary. I obviously think, you know, for a lot of reasons, I don't really count the 9 games this year too much for or against him. And obviously he has all of his recruiting ability in front of him, which is a big part of it, and everyone also, like, the program isn't going to be blindsided by whenever Hopkins takes over, because all the recruits that are coming in kind of know that that's the future, and if you're going to be here for a certain amount of time, that's, you know, what's going to take place. So I think the transition will be pretty as seamless as it can possibly be moving on from a Hall of Famer. But it really is, like, if you look at it from an outside perspective, it's pretty unprecedented or close to it. And hopefully it works out, because if not, things are going to get really weird with Syracuse basketball really quick.
Well, I mean, I think they already did, to be honest, based on just the 9 games. I mean, you saw a fan base that very quickly became largely despondent, very negative. The quote-unquote specialness kind of wore off from the program, and I hate talking about Penn State and Syracuse in the same breath, because I think it creates an unfair narrative and a certain amount of lines drawn and finger-pointing. But at the same time, that there is a there's a cult of personality that, in very different ways, mind you, but a cult of personality that existed around Penn State and Joe Paterno, and a cult of personality that has existed around Jim Boeheim. And I feel like Penn State fans, unfortunately, rallied in a negative way around the team defining its personality without Paterno. And I feel like Syracuse fans, because they're not Paterno truthers and creepy Penn State fans, instead kind of retreated, if that makes any sense, during those nine games when the basketball really wasn't looking like a great product.
Yeah, I think you're onto something there. It definitely was. It definitely didn't feel the same, just because. And I think there's also this like weird contingent of like super vehemently anti-Boeheim Syracuse fans, or
which I don't know. I don't know how you exist at this point, but
whatever. I know. I'm not saying you have to be like you know, I don't think you have to pledge fealty to Boeheim to be a Syracuse fan, but I don't know how you root for a program where you hate the head coach of 40 years so much. It's just like, it seems unfeasible, and you should probably root for another program.
Like any other program.
But that portion of people is, I feel like, way louder than outside fans probably realize. They probably think that the, you know, loyalty to Boeheim is more along the lines of the Paterno thing. But it's really like, there's a lot of people who will not be so upset when Boeheim leaves. And I don't know if that's a good or bad thing, but they're definitely a part of this fan base, a strange sect.
Yeah, and I think you got to it a little bit, that like, we're never going to understand the motives of these people, and you know what, yeah, you have every right to it, but I don't know if Syracuse is the program for you, if you're going to be so attached to or hateful of a coach that's been here this long. It might be time to look elsewhere, because this, at least for the time being, is how this program's going to run itself, with one guy who's going to be there for a very long time until he does something to show he doesn't deserve the job anymore.
And he's in around the 2-3 zone.
And only the 2-3 zone. Unless you want to run man-to-man, then do that. Yeah, run man-to-man. More man-to-man.
I mean, he might run the press for like a minute.
Just once. He'll count it out 60 seconds and then... And then, he'll immediately order it back. I think that's a good place for halftime, Dan. If you're all right with it,
that works for me.
Cool. So, what have you been drinking?
I am still pulling up my list. Drank something. Oh, so I didn't have a ton, but the couple things I did have, I had I had two different Ballast Points over the weekend. I had Grapefruit Stolpen just because it's there, and I don't remember the last time I saw Grapefruit Stolpen on a menu and I didn't end up ordering at least one. So that was necessary. But I also had their Ginger Big Eye IPA, which I really enjoyed. It's definitely different from the Stolpen, and the ginger flavor I thought was really well utilized and really well balanced with the IPA. It, more of like a finish. But really nice departure from what they normally do, but I thought it was a nice addition to their, you know, their general Stolpen line and everything. So that was good. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, honestly, like Ballast Point, you're not going to go wrong with anything they do in terms of their variations of beers. They've just they've really put a great amount of time and investment. I mean, all these beers too that the rest of the country is just like starting to get a glimpse of because of their increased distribution with Constellation and all that. These are things that have been making the rounds around San Diego for years and have been, you know, tossed around. They have an R&D kitchen in downtown San Diego over by Little Italy that just has these beers on tap along with some of their staples. And so these are things that, you know, locals have raved about for years, and it's awesome because, you know, now we're seeing that there's an ability to you know, get those beers out in bottles and get people outside the San Diego area to try them. And it's a testament to how good they are that they're all so on point, you know, each and every time.
Yeah. I mean, I've only had a handful of their stuff, but even like, I had one of the porters a couple of weeks back, and like, that's not my, I'm not a huge porter guy, but even that was like, you know, very good. I haven't had a bad thing from Ballast Point. So again, that's why I end up ordering a Grapefruit Stolpen all the time. So never really does wrong.
Fair enough. All right. From me, what do we got? Last week I've been drinking, had a Well, jury duty ended last Thursday, which was great for me. So to celebrate, popped open a Phil Mishmish from the brewery. It's an apricot sour, very, very good stuff. Also had a Melange number 1 from the brewery. That beer is very interesting. It's a blend of the Eau de Tarte and their Black Tuesday. So it's a weird kind of sour bourbon barrel-aged imperial stout, a mixture between those two that I would highly recommend to anyone who appreciates either style. You really do get that the full flavor of both in there. Had a Prairie Bomb, which Prairie is always great. And I mean, sometimes their bottles are a little pricey, but always worth grabbing some if that's around. Did a little South Bay beer tour over the weekend, so I had a bunch of different things from the usual spots. Had Spellcheck from Monkish. It was kind of a hoppy pale ale from them. Had some Cafe Della Vita. It was a basically a pistachio, vanilla, and coffee saison. It was a very, very interesting mixture, but one that really worked. They don't bottle that one, but really did enjoy that. And then, yeah, it was just a lot of the usual stuff elsewhere over at Monkish and Smog City. Amarillo Gorilla, Cuddlebug, etc., etc. Yeah, moving on to bracketology. I guess we'll pull that up because now we don't even have to make homework picks for Syracuse because they're not even going to be in.
Yeah, I loved them to get in, and if they get in, there's not going to be any apologizing. But just looking, it really doesn't seem like there's an obvious path to it unless the selection committee, for whatever reason, takes the Boeheim absence into huge account. And when that happened, I was kind of in the mindset of, you know, depending on how it played out, I think it's something you look at, but it's not obviously the biggest factor. But I think with the team losing 5 of its last 6, it kind of takes away from the impact that Boeheim might have had. I don't know if that's fair or not, but it's hard to say, you know, oh, this team totally turned it around when Boeheim came back, when they ended up having an even worse stretch to end the year with him.
Yeah, I would think that that's pretty accurate. I think, you know, I said it in the article I wrote today, you know, after his comments about, you know, Syracuse having suffered enough. And I agree to a point, but I think suffer enough, I don't think suffer includes making the NCAA tournament when you don't deserve to. And that's going to be the difference maker. I think the tournament committee, if I'm the tournament committee, I probably look at this group of teams and I'm not overly thrilled with any of them, but I just don't know if you can go with Syracuse over some of them. And that's assuming that the bubble stays the way it is. I think a lot of people, and you know, we said this internally on the Slack page, just a lot of people just seem to convince themselves that the bubble was going to stay the way it was and that upsets weren't going to happen and the other teams couldn't play their way up or down and just saw Syracuse's place for what it was. And if you looked at the end of the regular season, I agree. Syracuse was safe no matter what happened. But the problem is that no matter what happened, caveat has to be there. You saw 4 upsets that we didn't need to happen in conference tournaments around the country. You're going to see more that are probably going to hurt us, and we'll see what happens from here. But Dan, speaking from my own experience, this isn't going to go well for Syracuse, not because of anti-Syracuse bias or anything like that, but just for the sake of there isn't the quality of wins there to help them out here. I wouldn't say that. I say they have the quality of wins, but the problem is they don't have much else. The computer numbers aren't overly strong. I know the strength of schedule is good, not great. The RPI is barely good. It's around 60s. It's probably going to be a little bit worse tomorrow. There's little helping Syracuse besides a couple marquee wins, and that might be the only thing if they do get in that gets them in over a team maybe like Monmouth or maybe not Wichita State, but like St. Mary's, perhaps.
Yeah, it's you're hanging your hat basically on a handful of wins over, you know, teams that went out and played consistent basketball, which is rough. And if it was like one or two teams, like if it was just Syracuse and then Monmouth or like St. Bonaventure's, if they were to lose their tournament, you know, Syracuse has a head-to-head win over one, and Monmouth has some nice wins, but then they play in a lot weaker conference. So I could say, you know, Syracuse obviously was in the ACC and had to deal with this Boeheim thing. You know, they're inconsistent, but they can beat top teams, where Monmouth, you know, they beat USC and UCLA, which is fine. But like, when you're up against what seems like a group of 10 or so teams that are all kind of bunched together, including, you know, teams you've beat and lost to, and just this whole cluster, it makes it really hard for 19 and 13 Syracuse, which looks like a total mess on the court down the stretch, whether or not they still count like that final 10 games or whatever they used to. It's a really hard sell. There just seems like too many people ahead to jump. Like, it just seems like the odds are stacked against you based on the different criteria of the selection committee members and whatnot. The odds aren't that a bunch of people don't have the same exact idea of what Syracuse is versus, you know, just one or two of these other schools getting in these points ahead with RPI and whatnot.
No, absolutely. And you know, you look at some of these marquee wins too, like a team like Connecticut, which has almost played its way out unless they do something, you know, better in the American Athletic Conference tournament. I think there's a lot of other bubble teams kind of hanging around that still have a chance. I mean, I would consider at this point, because of how weak the bubble is, anybody 9 or lower. So that means even schools like VCU still have plenty to play in front of them that only serves to help their case. I think a team like Cincinnati is the same way. USC, Vandy, Colorado. Like, there's a lot of teams that I wouldn't necessarily say are better than Syracuse at all. and yet, you know, as long as they just do what they're supposed to do here, which is maybe win a game in the conference tournament, they'll be fine. And that's all Syracuse had to do, and they didn't. So I guess at the end of the day, if anyone's mad at the tournament committee for this, I don't know how you could be, because just look at the resume. We didn't get to the 20-win mark. We finished 500 in league play. We didn't win a conference tournament game, which we haven't done since we got to the ACC, by the way, which kills me. And we really haven't – we've put up one marquee victory in the last, like, month and a half, 2 months.
Right. And it's just – overall, like, I can't get worked up if Syracuse gets left out, which seems, again, like the likely scenario here. If Syracuse had beaten Florida State or Pitt, I think they're in. And the only people to blame for that not happening is SU. So if the committee leaves us out, that is the thing that I expect, and I will look forward to enjoy. Well, I guess I'll look forward to enjoying a tournament without stress in terms of who wins and loses, and I look forward to paying a very bare amount of attention to the NIT.
Agree there. Hofstra, we look forward to facing you in the first round.
Bring it on, Pride.
Fun fact. Hofstra was my other safety school along with UConn.
Yeah, UConn, I mean, I got into UConn. That was a thing. I visited. It was Drury and Storrs.
Same.
And, like, not, and, well, so I visited Syracuse, and it was, like, the end of April, and it was my last, it was, like, the week before I had to choose, and my mom packed, like, we were going to Siberia, and it ended up being, like, 95 degrees the whole weekend and sunny. But I think I don't think that had a real impact on my choice or not. UConn's just in like the worst part of Connecticut,
like the absolute, like the sixth borough.
Storrs is all.
There's a reason why it's the sixth borough, because nobody talks about
it. It's really bad. Like, Storrs is legitimately in the middle of nowhere. UConn's a good school. Like, I have a lot of friends who went to, like, a ton of friends who went to UConn. Yeah. I visited there multiple times. I've had good times there. If it wasn't in Storrs and it was like in somewhat of an interesting town,
Bridgeport. No, not Bridgeport.
Maybe New Haven.
There you go.
New Haven is a fun college town. Bridgeport, maybe not so much. But yeah, UConn being in Storrs is kind of a deal breaker.
Agreed. All right, looking at brackets now that we had our requisite UConn talk. Looking at Lenardi's bracket from March 9th. We start in the Midwest, and I'm seeing Kansas with a – why does Kansas always get this interesting matchup? I've got Kansas-Duke as a pretty clear pick for the Sweet 16, and I'm going with Kansas, especially now that we know that Emil Jefferson's out for the season. Looking at the other side, I don't want to do this, but we're careening our way to the Elite Eight, and I am giving – Tom Crean and his gang of Hoosier miscreants the free pass to the Elite Eight here, where they will lose the Jayhawks.
Yeah, like I was thinking about this today, and just about teams that I'm excited to pick, and Indiana's just, I feel like it took so long for people to like actually acknowledge, and I'm totally part of this. I'm not throwing anyone under the bus, but Indiana, like, really from Big Ten, the start of Big Ten play on, has been very good, and they haven't really let up. Like, they've had some weird games here and there, but who hasn't? And heading into the season, I think we talked about it a couple times, like, they're one of the most talented teams in college basketball. They just, you know, they have the Tom Prime factor, so they could totally lose at any point in this tournament, but on paper, it's tough to pick against them. I agree on Kansas over Duke, like you said. I just don't think Duke has the depth this year. They have six guys. They've had like injury stares beyond Emile Jefferson, which would just totally derail them.
That said, Arkansas Little Rock is a pretty prime upset pick for against Iowa, who's been an absolute free fall for the last couple weeks.
Yeah, and Stephen F. Austin's been, I don't know how they are this year specifically, but they've been a really salty team for a while. So, like, nothing would shock me with Duke. Like, they could beat Kansas because Grayson Allen's really good when he's not being the worst on the court. I'm going to take Indiana too. I'm tempted to take Texas, but I think Indiana's just, like, playing really good ball. They're super talented. I'll take Kansas over Indiana just because I trust them more. Now I'm like, I'm going to have a real internal debate over whether to take Indiana to lose like immediately or to actually have them make a run, because everything tells me, like, my brain says Crean, but my heart says, like, I watch that team and they're actually a lot of fun.
Yeah, like, and I think you're right. That is everybody's problem with Indiana. You look at them and you're like, fuck, it's Crean.
Like, I actually think it's the other way around. I think my heart says Crean. And my brain says they're actually pretty good. I'm not sure which part of my body says Crean.
Whichever part, it's probably wrong. Moving to the South, Virginia is the number one seed over here. They don't have Michigan State in this bracket, so rejoice, Hoos fans. You get to avoid that fate potentially. I oddly would like Vandy to upset them, but I won't do that. I would comfortably put Virginia in the Elite Eight here, based on what he spells out. Then on the other side, I've got Oklahoma pretty easily, based on this gaggle of teams. Like, Utah's the only one that's really kind of feisty. And then I've got Oklahoma beating Virginia to get themselves to the Final Four.
Yeah, I think this is a week where we're going to have a lot of the same stuff. Virginia, I just don't think any of those teams, like, you know, Purdue's interesting, they can play tough, and Iowa State, you know, is fun, but they play no defense. UVA, they're just due. They're due for a good run with this team. I'm tempted to take Utah just because they've been playing such good basketball over the last couple of weeks, and they really played themselves into prime position down the stretch here. I'm going to stick with Oklahoma like you. Buddy Hield's just too good. And I just trust that roster a little more. Notre Dame could be interesting. I think a Notre Dame-Oklahoma game would be a blast. I'm kind of rooting for that at some point, because that'd just be a lot of points. But I think the Sooners out of the bottom there.
I don't know if Notre Dame, like, well, okay. If it was anybody but St. Joe's, I would say Notre Dame probably loses a 7-10 game. But with St. Joe's kind of playing iffy themselves, I'll take the Irish begrudgingly. But yeah, I think that Oklahoma seems like a pretty good bet here. We'll just kind of have to play wait and see. I mean, Oklahoma obviously hasn't played as like they did for a good portion of the season, which I think was one of the top two or three teams in the country. They've kind of fallen off a little bit, but I still buy Oklahoma getting to the Final Four based on the strength of the Big 12, which I know seems stupid at times. We do kind of... I feel like we pan that concept, but not nearly as much as we pan other tropes that have existed, like the strength of the Big Ten, which is largely a joke, or Iowa as a national title contender, which is obviously a big joke, or Iowa State as a national title contender, which Dan and I have finally rid ourselves of. I feel like we can look at Oklahoma's body of work this year as a clear measure of a team that can compete, and if Utah might be the toughest team they have to get by based on recent play, But I think Utah and Virginia are going to be a good test. And if Oklahoma can get by those two teams, they stand a very good chance to win it all in the Final Four.
Yeah, Oklahoma just needs to right the ship a little bit since they've been sloppy. But the Big 12 is such a bear that, you know, it's understandable. All these Big 12 teams have suffered a lot of losses, and it's just because that conference, I legitimately think, is really good. Big 10, I think they're a little better at the top this year, but like the bottom of that conference is as bad as like atrocious. Anything. Yeah, like people used to make fun of like the Big East, the bottom of the Big East for being this so bad. Worse. This is way worse. Like Rutgers, Minnesota are two of the worst teams, like two of the worst power conference teams I've ever seen. Like those two in BC could have some like amazing round robin of this awfulness.
Gotta include Wake in there.
Yeah, Wake sneaky awful and by year's end this year. And then even like Illinois is just a bad team. A lot of this is just bad. So yeah, Big 12 good, Big 10 like some parts good, but the bottom is like
mostly bad.
Yeah, and they were always so critical about the Big East, the bottom of the Big East being a tire fire, which in a lot of ways it was, but
so they took one of those tires and put it on the
They literally just took a flat tire off of a car that like was lit on fire on the side of the highway after an accident. It's like, yep, we're gonna drive on this.
Yeah, well, these spare parts will work.
No one's using this tire. Oh, Rutgers.
Moving down to the East, Villanova and Wichita State, or Cincinnati, really seems like a really fun. Like either of those teams are going to beat Villanova.
Yeah, I mean, Wichita State is just like the classic, you know, they have all this tournament experience and the two seniors that have been there for a million years and have made all these runs like that. And then Cincinnati is just Cincinnati, where like at any given point, like they'll either play the worst team of all time or they'll shove you in a locker. And that feels like that could happen here.
Honestly, I see, like, is it bad that the only team in this bracket I don't think can beat Villanova is Hampton?
I mean,
every one of these teams like stands a good chance to beat them.
Yeah, I don't know too much about Asheville, but they, you know, I remember the Asheville game with us, which wasn't fun. And again, I don't think Asheville's going to make it to the Elite Eight. Florida,
even like, look at their half, and there is not one team on that list other than Hampton that I go, yeah, Villanova's going to beat that team.
I think definitively, if I was filling out a bracket, I'd pick them over either of the 16s. This Gulf Coast, like, this isn't Dunk City. I watched that Gulf Coast tournament game. I don't think they dunked once. Yeah. They're
false
still, you
advertising.
Know, yeah, they lost Dunk City. I think I'd pick Nova to beat the 16s. I think I'd probably take them over South Dakota State, but I would think about it, and I'd take them over Chattanooga, and I'd take the rest of that whole top half to beat them, I think.
I hate this half because I really like all of those games, like, a lot. Like, Wichita-Cincinnati just seems like a fun 8-9. Cal-South Dakota State, I think Cal's feisty. South Dakota is equally feisty. A&M, if they can get themselves up to a 3-line, I think they'd help themselves a lot. Otherwise, they're going to be stuck in a really shitty game against a good 13 seed because there are a lot of them. And I think Chattanooga might be the best of them, which, again, problematic for them. I still think Cal and A&M get through. I think Cal beats A&M. And then I got Cal beating, I'm going to say beats Villanova. I wouldn't have much confidence picking Villanova against Wichita State or Cincinnati, but that said, I'll give Villanova the benefit of the doubt that they can actually get past an 8 seed or a 9 seed this year. But I don't have them beating Cal. So I got Cal in the Elite Eight, and they will be facing, drumroll, Michigan State. I think Texas Tech is feisty. I think Monmouth or the Bonnies could really challenge them, but I think Texas Tech could challenge Michigan State as well, but I think Michigan State still gets through. I think Miami gets through by default in that other kind of sub-region just because Arizona's been flailing, Temple's hasn't been consistent, UNC Wilmington. I just don't think they're going to be a trendy upset pick, but I think Miami's too talented to lose a game like that. So, yeah, I've got Michigan State over Miami, and then I've got Michigan State over Cal in the Elite Eight.
Yeah, I had the same thing. I was actually mapping this out first, too. The Cal A&M game, I like both those teams a lot. I picked A&M the last couple weeks to go. Cal just, like, they're coming out at the right time. They're super talented. They're young. We've seen teams like this kind of surge in the tournament before. But Michigan State's too much. Izzo is just a master, and Denzel Valentine is having one of the great college basketball seasons, I think. He's averaging over 19 points. He's averaging 7.5 assists and rebounds. Like, wow. I don't know why Michigan State keeps on finding these players that do everything like that, but it's really unbelievable. I'm kind of with you on the rest of this, too. Villanova, Wichita State, Cincinnati is fun to pick against Villanova. It's crazy that Nova has not made it out of the round of 32 since they went to the Final Four in 09, and they've had two seeds and a one seed since then. So, like, part of me feels like this should be, you know, eventually Nova has to make it to the Sweet 16 and progress. At least get that far.
Yeah, you get one round.
Yeah, but I still, just something about them just makes them so untrustworthy. So I don't really know if I'd pick them over Wichita or Cincinnati or not. It's tough. I'd be very tempted to take the Shockers, I think.
Could you imagine, like, I mean, it would be kind of perfect if Villanova was the first one seed to lose to a 16. And if it was Florida Gulf Coast, and to be honest, Hampton and Florida Gulf Coast are both two of the tournament's historic best giant killers. I would love to see, if a one seed was going to go down, it would be so appropriate to be Villanova.
Oh, if Gulf Coast beat Villanova, like, I wouldn't take the same just, like, total joy out of it as I took them beating Georgetown, which, like, is one of my favorite tournament games ever.
Agreed.
I watched that with a bunch of Syracuse friends, and we watched the Syracuse game as well that day, and we enjoyed the Gulf Coast team so much more. But it would still be hilarious. So I'm fine with that. If Villanova has – and I don't hate Villanova at all. They're just really funny because of their – their tournament stuff. So you know, there's still a little bit of the Big East isn't actually all that good. They have like one good team, and that one good team always loses in the first weekend of the tournament. So yeah, I'm sorry, Villanova, to pick on you, and we really don't, we can't say much. We're not going to be in the tournament, but
no.
This is your fate. You are destined to win 28 games a year in the regular season and win the Big East and then go lose to someone hilarious in the first weekend.
I'm fine with that. Also of note in here is something I will point out is that Michigan State, while they're a two seed right now, I think if Michigan State can find their way to a win in the Big Ten tournament, and perhaps if Villanova doesn't get things done at Madison Square Garden or North Carolina falters, or Virginia too, to be honest, I could see Michigan State playing its way up to a one line. I think that's well within play right now.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think I wrote something about that the other week. Like, I think Michigan State's just playing such good basketball right now, and obviously they lost the Big Ten regular season because of them faltering when Valentine was hurt and a little after that, but they're playing the best basketball in that conference right now, and if they win the tournament, I think it'd be very hard to keep them off the one line.
Agreed. And last in the West, North Carolina's bracket. Carolina gets a pretty easy pass through the first two rounds. Yale is going to be a really, really intriguing upset pick for a lot of people on 12-5. Maryland, if that were to hold. Maryland just played atrociously in the last couple weeks. And they're very talented, to be honest. And it's just that the Terps can't be consistent enough for me to believe. Kentucky gets a feisty Stony Brook, but not one that could beat them. A North Carolina-Kentucky game is going to happen in the Sweet 16, and everyone's going to hate it. I've got North Carolina winning that one, though, because Kentucky just... there's just something missing this year, and that's fine. Everyone has their down years, and if your down year is a four seed, or you get to the Sweet 16, I think you'll take that. On the other half, I've got... I'd be tempted to pick Wisconsin to get through here just because Wisconsin's played better than almost anybody in the country over the last probably 8 weeks. But saying that, I'm going to go with West Virginia. I think West Virginia and Wisconsin are the two best teams down here. I notably never buy Oregon in any sport. I've got Oregon getting themselves a Sweet 16, losing to West Virginia. I got North Carolina beating West Virginia in the regional final.
So I'll actually differ from you here, finally. I have Kentucky, North Carolina, like you do. I'm going to have the Cats going. I just feel like Kentucky's doing that thing where they come on right at the right time. They have the best backcourt in the country, in my opinion. And then the scariest thing about Kentucky is this: in the last two games, Stan Labissiere like rediscovered how to play basketball. Against LSU in their season finale, he had 18, 9, and 6 blocks, and he was better than Ben Simmons. So if he, I mean, that could also just be like a two-game spurt that he's had. But I mean, if he's having any kind of impact similar to that, it's going to be very hard to beat Kentucky with Murray and Ulis and Labissiere being impactful. So I'll take them over North Carolina to go to the Elite Eight. Maryland, like you said, is just playing such bad basketball over the last month. They've that Minnesota team that we talked about being really awful. Maryland lost to them like 2 weeks ago.
Way to go, Terps.
So that was a thing that happened. I'm going to go with Wisconsin over Oregon in the bottom after beating West Virginia. I actually would even think about taking Iona over West Virginia as of just because, you know, I feel like that's probably the most likely 14-3 here. West Virginia is good, but I feel like they're a team whose style could get hampered in tournament play. And Wisconsin, I think, just has experience. They've rallied around Red Guard, and they have some, you know, some nice players coming along at the right time. So I'm going to take Wisconsin, Kentucky in a rematch of last year's Final Four game, and I'll take Kentucky to go to the Final Four.
Boo. All right, so looking at another Blue Blood Final Four, save one. Largely, we're kind of in agreement here. Kansas, Oklahoma, Michigan State, and then either North Carolina or Kentucky.
Yeah, it's been, I think we've kind of come to these conclusions over the last couple of weeks. They've been pretty similar depending on who gets lined up where.
Yeah, I feel like 1 week we're aligned, the next week we're not, and then...
Yep, but I think the four teams we've had, like, kind of, we're kind of reaching where we're going to get.
Agreed. Yeah, I think Kentucky is a pretty, I think Kentucky's easily one of the top 5 to 7 picks nationally to win it all. I'm sure in Vegas, and definitely when the brackets are all kind of settled on Sunday, I think you'll see very quickly that the Cats become, you know, one of the...
The trendy four, yeah.
Here's a non-1 or 2 seed that surprises everybody and wins it all. Like, yeah, that definitely sounds like Kentucky to me. Dan, if there was one surprise team on this bracket, you can go anybody lower than a 3 seed that you think can win it all other than Kentucky, who might that team be?
Lower than a 3 seed other than Kentucky. Let me see. That's tough. I feel like there's really... We've kind of had this strange tier emerge in the last couple of weeks here of, like, the haves. And like, I feel like there's, like, 10 teams that have kind of distanced themselves from the rest. And they're all really in the top 3 lines.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, I'll find one for you.
I might have to go with A&M.
I like A&M. They don't feel like a national champion to me.
No.
They don't have, like, that guy. And that guy thing, I feel, and this is also going to be unpopular, this will be as unpopular as my Kentucky take. Duke has 2 of the best players in the country, and that counts for a lot.
Yeah, I think you're right there. I think, what was that, again, I know we talked about this, like, a couple weeks ago. There was that stat of, like, Syracuse in 2003 was, like, the only national title winner in the last, like, 20 years without an NBA guard on the roster. And I think that there is something to it. It's not a cause and effect. It's more of just a good players equal good teams equals winning national championship. Like, yes, there's some luck involved, but looking down this list, A&M's a candidate, but maybe not the candidate.
I think you can go A&M. I think Cal's really talented. They could do, but I don't buy them as I think they're like a year or two away if some of these guys stay around.
What about Texas?
Texas is interesting because Shaka's style really disrupts people.
And he knows, I mean, he knows how to coach in the tournament.
That too. I thought about that.
Very well. Yeah, I mean, if Crean, if we're looking at peak Crean, there's the chance that they lose to Texas in round 2. There's also the chance that Crean loses to an experienced, upset-minded UAB team that upset Iowa State last year.
Yeah. And then the other team, if in terms of just pure talent, I mean, I would say Maryland, but they've just looked so bad. But if they turn it around, I mean, they have like one or two seed talent, I think.
Well, yeah, and that, you know, that speaks to another thing here, and that was kind of what I was alluding to at Michigan State, is that, like, there's a lot of teams here that are, like, I'd say that there's still 16 to 20 teams that are talented enough to be on the first two lines, but because of inconsistency or injuries or whatever it may be, they're not there. So, if somebody gets hot, I mean, Maryland has the elements that you need for a potential tournament run. And I'm hesitant to pick the Terps because of their, like, just abject awfulness over the last couple of weeks. But you know, never say never if they just finally figure... Like, if they can get themselves to the Big Ten final, you can pencil in the Terps in my Final Four.
Yeah, it's just a matter of them kind of catching some heat, because they've just been... I looked up today. It was basically since February 14th, they've lost 4 of 6, and they've lost, like I said, to Minnesota. Some of the losses aren't too bad, just as a one-off. But when you're playing that poorly, it's really hard to really buy back in. But if you just, you know, put that aside, they have one of the best guards in college basketball, Melo Trimble. They have Diamond Stone, who's he's a problem as a center. Like, when he's good, he's really good. He dropped 39 earlier this year at some point. I forget, it's 2. They have a number of, like, really nice complimentary players. So I don't know really what the problem is with... I don't know what the reason why they have been playing so poorly is, but they definitely have the pieces. So, but like we said earlier, like, they just have played so poorly that it's hard to envision it. But if they do make a run in the Big Ten tournament and they seem like they've righted the ship, then I expect them to be a pretty... attractive pick as a 4-ish seed.
Yeah, and that's how we'll end our podcast, talking about Maryland basketball, because if there's one thing you can count on here, it's that we'll not talk about Syracuse for 30 minutes at a time.
Especially not today. Today was not that day.
Nope, not today. Dan, as always, thanks for making some time today.
Anytime. We're coming for you, Hofstra.
Hofstra, you know it's going to happen, and because of the women's tournament, we'll probably end up playing down Long Island. So for all the Syracuse fans in New York City and on the island, you'll actually be able to go to the game, probably.
Hey, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, you definitely shouldn't.
I would be much more interested in driving up to the Dome for the women's team.
That said, I've been to basketball games at Hofstra, and they have a similar setup that a couple other teams have this, but it's one of the, like, pit type of setups where it's like a step down into the stadium.
Oh, that's strange.
Yeah, like a couple teams have that, but like it's an interesting setup. It actually gets pretty loud there, but yeah, I'm not going to claim it's the Dome or anything like that. On that note, after illustriously describing where Hofstra plays basketball, that was Dan. I'm John. You've been listening to Troy Noon's An Absolute Podcast. You can rate, review, subscribe on Blog Talk, on iTunes, and hopefully, by some miracle, Syracuse makes the tournament. But if not, we will be here next week. Don't worry.
Go women's basketball.
Go women's basketball.